Welcome to the Power Play Podcast, where international cricketer Kyron Powell and marketing genius Jordan Shannon join forces, bringing you captivating conversations with the biggest players in cricket and business. Join us as we dive into the lives of current stars in the cricketing world, the legends before them, and those extraordinary icons whose performances changed the game in both cricket and business. Exploring journeys both on and off the pitch, the boardroom, and everything in between. Get ready for an exhilarating blend of cricket, life, and business insights with two insatiably passionate, infuriatingly no-holds-barred hosts, who, unfortunately for the rest of us, live and breathe this stuff for a living.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 30 of the Power Play Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Shannon, and as always, I'm joined by Kyron Powell. But today, we have a special guest. We are joined by Mashal Hewitt. And how are you, Mashal?
I'm doing very good, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. Mashal is part of the host of the Caribbean Cricket Podcast, which has been going for a few years now. So how did your love of the game start?
I always say that I'm no different to anybody from, I guess, my generation who was born in the Caribbean, or even if you're part of the diaspora, which most people would say I am now. I was fortunate in that I grew up with a father who passed on the love of the game to me. And that doesn't mean, and the interesting thing is, like, people always say to me, oh, did you play it a lot? No, I didn't. Like, recreationally, yeah. But I never took it seriously as a sport that I wanted to play. But that almost speaks to the culture in the Caribbean that certainly when I grew up, everybody was a cricket fan. So whether you played or not was almost irrelevant. If West Indies were playing, you supported West Indies. And that was seen as kind of critical to the fabric of people of the Caribbean, both within the different islands and nations themselves, as well as when we moved over to the UK, people within the diaspora, whether in the UK, North America, or whatever it might be. So I always say it was just part of the oral tradition that existed 30 years ago, that it just got passed down, that you supported the West Indies cricket team and by extension loved cricket.
Yeah, so you mentioned there in terms, obviously, it came from your father, but who did you look up to from a cricketing perspective, and who sort of inspired you in those early stages of your cricketing career as such?
So we moved over to the UK when I was four when we came over to the UK. But my parents, the family moved back to Jamaica when I was 16. So I did my A-levels in Jamaica. And the reason why I'm using that as the segue to this story is I have the UK experience of going through the UK school system. So we played cricket at school, but I wouldn't say I had any inspiration in the UK system. But when we got back home, Jimmy Adams went to, so my dad's a pastor, and Jimmy Adams attended the church that we went to. And at the time, Jimmy was the captain. He just got the captaincy of the West Indies cricket team. So to me, Jimmy was like a massive hero. And it was like, wow, the captain of the West Indies cricket team comes to my church. But in the Caribbean, we're like, we don't really do celebrity in the Caribbean. He was just somebody who went to church, if you see what I mean. So like, you could stop Jimmy and just have a conversation with Jimmy, and then he'd be off on a test tour to wherever he would be going with the West Indies team. So I always say that we were fortunate, or I was fortunate, in that there was close proximity to famous cricketers, if that makes sense. So when people say to me, oh, who are the cricketers you looked up to? Jimmy, obviously I'm Jamaican, someone say Jamaican cricketers, Jimmy, Chris Gayle were certainly two that were like just prevalent around at the time. They were like, these are talented cricketers, and they are from the island that I'm from, if that makes sense.
Right, fantastic. So then in terms of like leading on to your, you know, your career now, in terms of from a, obviously being a host of the podcast Where did all that start, and where did the you know, where, what was the real stem of it?
So I think I'd always had, obviously I'd had an interest in cricket. So whenever the West Indies, by the time I'd come back to the UK, like university, etc., whenever the West Indies were on tour in the UK, I'd be there. Like I'd go to games, I'd go and watch, etc. And then it got to about, it's about 2017, 2018. And I kind of just got, by that point, I was writing for different sports outlets, albeit mainly football. And I was kind of getting a bit frustrated that there, to me, there wasn't a central West Indian outlet that you could read that took all the news from all the different islands. Traditionally, when you talk about West Indies cricket, everyone focuses on the big four. So they talk about Trinidad and Tobago, Barbados, Guyana, Jamaica. Obviously, Kieran's on the show. You won't get outlets focusing on cricketers from Nevis or from Antigua and Barbuda per se in comparison to the big four. And even with the big four, you're only going to get the newspapers and media outlets within those respective nations focusing on their own cricketers and their role within the kind of wider context of the West Indies team. So I just felt at the time there's nothing out there that draws everything in one, where you can read it, listen to it, watch it, whatever it might be, and you're just as likely to hear about cricket in Antigua as you are to hear about cricket in St. Vincent or St. Martin or Guyana or wherever. And it's something that we haven't historically done well in the Caribbean in terms of, and it's probably why insularity exists within the region, because we don't see it as a collective whole. We champion our own cricketers from our own island before we look at the collective whole as West Indies cricket. So that's what brought the notion of trying to create something. You know, it's that idea that if something isn't being done, don't complain about it, do it yourself. So that's effectively what led to it.
Did you feel that you had the knowledge and the sort of to be able to cover the whole broad of it, you know, in terms of like the whole Caribbean as a whole? You mentioned there about the obviously the four empowering nations, but did you feel like you could cover it enough?
When we first started, so initially when it started, myself and Santoki Nagilendran, who's the other co-host, at the time we thought, well, let's just start by just talking about what we do know is in the news. Right. And what that involved was, obviously you've got the major stories which might break on like an ESPN, Crick Info or a Crick Buzz or whatever it might be. We knew a few people behind the scenes, not a lot. And then, of course, you have to trawl the kind of newspapers of each of the islands. So in Jamaica, you might read the Observer or the Gleaner. In Trinidad, you might read Trinidad and Tobago Newsday or News Express. I can't remember what it's called. Barbados Nation. So we started trawling the different islands and trying to get the information from each one and doing it that way. But like I say, it's hard because it's not like there's a... back then when we started it, I would say that there wasn't a regular update of news. So when we first started, we knew that it was always going to be difficult to find the news. But West Indies cricket is so chaotic that we knew that something was always going to be going on, if that makes sense. So regardless of whether you could find what was going on in each island, the big stories were all, like at the time we started, it was around the time when, I'm thinking of our first episode, Pollard had just become captain of the West Indies white ball side. And that caused huge consternation across the whole region because various people didn't like him and they said he shouldn't have been. So everything in, I think it was a phrase that was said to me by a former cricketer. It's politics in cricket in our region before the cricket. So when it's politics, there's so much to go off. But you've always got something to talk about.
And then from from that starting and stuff, how did you start to see it grow, and what sort of avenue did you go down to sort of helping the channel sort of grow as such?
I think lockdown played a huge role. Right. The pandemic played a huge role, because at the time we started, if people ever go back and listen to probably the first four episodes, like the tech, we sound like we were recording the episodes underwater. So the tech has improved significantly from then. But we always felt that we were talking about things that mattered from the jump, from the get-go. We knew that we were talking about things that mattered. We gambled and believed that there was enough of a diaspora within the UK and particularly in North America that probably felt the same way we did, that we don't get the news. It doesn't come to us as easily as it does to people in the Caribbean. And there's a massive fan base in both the UK and North America that wants to know what's going on in West Indies cricket. But when the pandemic came, it allowed us to record more frequently. It allowed us to come up with a strategy of recording. And because everybody was sitting in their houses, it also meant that we could start to reach out to people, because people didn't have anything to do, really and truly, if you see what I mean. So Kieran was one of the first to come on. I can't remember what episode it was. I want to say maybe episode 8, 9, something like that.
Right.
Kieran was the first cricketer to come on, I think. Or maybe it was Ramnaresh Salem. One of the two of them was first. And then once we had one cricketer, so take Kieran and then take Sarwan, once you then have one or two, and then you're starting to reach out to like some of the stakeholders, Kieran played a more critical role than he probably realizes, because it gave us a level of legitimacy that, okay, they've got a current at the time former, but then obviously Kieran went on to play again for West Indies, international on the show. Then when people listened to that, they would have realized that we weren't just some like cowboys asking dumb questions that have no relevance to anything. Like we'd studied his career. We knew what type of things to be talking about, right?
Yeah.
So then once you get that kind of legitimacy that, okay, they actually understand what they're talking about, or they know what type of questions to ask, it became easier to reach out to others.
Yeah.
And then it was about trying to reach out to stakeholders, because it's not just about cricket isn't about just speaking to cricketers. You need to be speaking to everybody who's involved in the game, from the pitch curators to people involved in the academy setup, to the CEO, to the president, to people within the regional boards across the different nations and islands. So it was about trying to speak to as many people as possible to weave the stories together.
Yeah.
And then once we'd done enough of that, and we're probably at a stage now where we don't have to speak to people to give it an air of legitimacy, if that makes sense. Like, I think people now see it as, okay, this is a concept, an outlet, an enterprise that talks on West Indies cricket with some level of gravitas and authority. And when they get someone on, people know it's going to be a very serious and good conversation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in terms of the early stages, maybe say, for instance, like your first 20 to 30, where was your listenership?
Good question. Initially, because we were based in London, it was the UK. As it grew, so let's take it up to 2030.
Yeah.
Because initially we started by just putting it on audio platforms. We didn't even realize that YouTube was an option. So that's what I'm saying. Like, we made things up as we went along. But it wasn't even on YouTube. We didn't even record like the interviews in terms of visually. We were just doing audio. YouTube as an option didn't come along until about midway through 2021, when we realized maybe we should actually put the visuals up somewhere. The audience initially started in the UK, and then it was just word of mouth. It was genuine word of mouth. We didn't do any major ad campaign. We didn't pay for like putting it like, you know, like what do you call those things, like promoted adverts or anything like that. It was just word of mouth. And then we started to realize that people are listening in the Caribbean. So yeah. Santolki, he's from Guyana. So, and because I'm from Jamaica, like in just through our own networks, it just went through like Chinese whispers just within those islands. And then, and then eventually America, particularly essentially the USA and kind of Canada. And it was the diaspora communities within those nations that really started. That's where our number one audience is. Even today, like if you, when we pull the numbers, it's always the United States where the biggest listenership comes from.
Right, cool. I wanted to ask that because of the fact that it was an overall Caribbean cricket podcast, is whether the audience sort of engaged from the early stages, or did it, you know, was it quite an organic growth through, like you mentioned there, with the word of mouth? So I was just curious to see how it developed at those early stages, really.
I would just add that we have a Caribbean-based listenership, but it's probably, so I've got my own theories about this, it's probably not as strong as it should be, because I always say to people here that one of the reasons why is that radio is still king in the Caribbean, and or I believe it's still king in the Caribbean, whereas in the UK and US, I think people will watch YouTube and say that's where I'm going to watch this show, or they will listen to audio podcasts. When I go home, like, people are still listening to the radio, so I don't it doesn't quite have the reach from in the Caribbean that it probably should have in the concept of a audio podcast platform. Like when we pull our audio numbers, it's always from like the United States, UK, India, Australia, etc. And there'll always be like Jamaica, Guyana, Trinidad, Barbados, but it's never as significant as the kind of like bigger nation. So yeah, there's a hurdle to overcome in that sense.
In terms of like the, you mentioned there about hurdles, what other hurdles did you feel like you had to overcome even still now potentially?
Kieran will laugh at this one, but it's true. Lack of authenticity is still a hurdle. I think, let me reframe that. We are authentic to stakeholders. So I think stakeholders know that if I reach out to a stakeholder in the game and say, can you come on the podcast? We want to talk about X. They will come on, generally speaking, as if their diary is clear enough, and they'll see it as an authentic medium that genuinely wants to talk about West Indies cricket. But when I say lack of authenticity, I think the audience back home, the accent throws them still. I was joking with a friend yesterday that if I just did the show in Patois, I think the show would be far more successful than it actually is, because it would bring a greater level of authenticity. I think some people still get thrown by the fact they hear the accent and immediately assume, well, I'm English, or I didn't grow up in the Caribbean. And when I tell people, no, I was born in Jamaica, I went to school in Jamaica, because of the accent, nobody thinks that that's a possibility. So I think that sometimes hinders the notion of what sounds weird, but what right do you have to talk on West Indies cricket, if you see what I mean?
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, I appreciate obviously going into that level, you know, obviously about, especially in terms of how it all started and, you know, some of the struggles that you've had and stuff there. Leading into, in terms of West Indies cricket at the moment, what sort of your take been, both in terms of obviously from the West Indies national side, but also from the regional perspective over the last sort of 12 months?
Okay, so when you have to, when you talk on West Indies cricket, you kind of have to, I always say you have to separate things, because I think sometimes people look at the health of West Indies cricket based on results on the pitch. And I always say that's the wrong way to look at it. Yes, it matters. And if West Indies lose to someone, then people say, oh, look at the state of West Indies cricket. But, and I don't say this just because Kieran's on the show, but I sometimes feel like the cricketers themselves are made the scapegoats for a system that isn't doesn't really support their development properly, if that makes sense. So if West Indies lose a game, it's not properly at all.
Second opinion, Norma. I just wanted to say it's at all.
So it's too easy when West Indies lose a game. It's too easy to say, "Oh, these cricketers and da 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 da," and how did they lose again, and so on and so forth. So the reason I start there is because really and truly, all eyes always have to start with, well, what's going on off the pitch? And when you're assessing the health of West Indies cricket, you have to look at what's going on off the pitch. Obviously, there's a new president in the last 12 months, Dr. Kishore Shallow. I'm trying to remember how long he's been in it. He just had, I think it's a year. I could be wrong now. My dates are all askew right now. I think it's a year. But we have a new president. Now, my personal view is that he is trying to take a different approach to how we develop some of the things within the region. But the problem that he will have, and probably any West Indies president will have, and Cricket West Indies as a whole, Cricket West Indies, unfortunately, as a kind of organization, I have to pick my words carefully here, isn't fit for purpose. Okay. That's not me saying that Kishore Shallow isn't fit for purpose. That's not the point I'm trying to make. But the structure of Cricket West Indies, when you properly dive into it, it doesn't really make a lot of sense how it runs as a structure, in terms of one central private organization with two directors from each of the associate cricket associations across the region. And it just means that whenever you're trying to move the cricket forward, you're beholden to all of the directors agreeing with the vision and agreeing that this is the way forward to improve West Indies cricket. And you can have a situation within the region, just take something as an example, like make up an example, where the Leeward Islands Cricket Association might say, we want to do X. Windward Islands say, we don't want it to go that way. And then Trinidad say, yeah, we agree with Leeward Islands. But Barbados is saying, no, we agree with Wind. Like from or just immediately from the jump, it's a complex web that I don't think other cricket boards, international cricket boards, have that same kind of barrier to development where, and that's why I used that phrase earlier on, where you're having to play politics before cricket. You're thinking about the political machinations and whose back you have to scratch in this particular island and which man on that board that you have to try and get on with, because if you don't get on with him, then he's probably going to go to his friend and then this can't happen, and so on and so forth. So when you, just using that as a microcosm of what I'm talking about, how are cricketers supposed to develop in that system? Because actually, they should be at the forefront of all the decisions, but they're probably the last thing in the actual decision making, because you have to get past all of the board machinations first before you can actually have a tangible impact on the cricketers and their development.
I think just to jump on that point a bit there, Mash, I don't think people understand the complexities or how deep the politics in West Indies cricket run, because as you said, like it's this island against that island, but it even goes, it's deep rooted into even the club system. So depending on what island you're from, if you play for a certain club, then you have a chance or a greater chance of making that island's team. And then if you went to a certain school or you're friends with certain people within certain teams, then you have a greater chance of moving on, et cetera, et cetera. So the politics in West Indies cricket, and then as we discussed with Faz last week with that seminar that they had, which is now getting politicians involved into West Indies cricket, which is a different complexity and a different level of politicking on a whole, because, you know, certain nations are going to want to have a bigger say or bigger sway because they feel as though that they are more of a traditional cricketing nation, or they invest more, or they get more tourists or whatever the case is throughout a series, so that we should be a number one destination as opposed to West Indies cricket being front and foremost in the overall strategic plan, which there never is. Or, well, let me not say there's never a strategic plan, but it's never executed because we can't agree to all go down the same path for any one set period of time. And that's the main issue with West Indies cricket. I mean, if you can create a strategic plan where you say, okay, in the next 2 years, we want to improve the infrastructure throughout the region. So each country is going to have basics, indoor facilities where players can train, whether it be day or night, access to more high-level qualified coaches. Obviously, there's a shortage of high-level qualified coaches in the Caribbean at the moment. So you can't necessarily say a player is going to have 10 level three coaches available to him, 10 level two coaches available to him, where in England, that's, I mean, a club team on a Saturday may have something like that, you know, access to boarding machines, et cetera, so just the basics for a player to develop. It's not readily available in the Caribbean, and so you find that we will always produce talent regardless of what the case is, but we're producing talent by nature rather than by nurture at the moment, whereas other countries around the world are creating players. So you'd find us at an under 19 level having exceptional talent and people being, oh my God, he's the one to watch. And then in 7 years' time, there was this guy at that under 19 World Cup. What's his? Can't remember. You know, that kind of effect, kind of thing. Whereas other countries, you'd be like, oh, this guy was an okay player at under 19, but my God, look at the quality of an international player that he's become for his country because of them continually to progress and develop and play enough cricket, which is something in the Caribbean. You can't develop players playing seven first-class games a year in a region that has 330 days of sunshine. That doesn't make any sense. You're playing 10 Super 50 games a year. Look, and then we're going to say that funding is an issue when you have people buying and building and investing into sports through so many sports investment funds around the world, and the US being 40 minutes away from Jamaica, and in general, 2 hours away from pretty much most Caribbean islands. There's access to funding everywhere. So, like, it's just putting the right people in the right places. And, you know, it's time for us to stop making excuses because West Indies cricket is something that, you know, most people around the world hold near and dear to that. Like, it's obviously something I'm very passionate about. It's given me the opportunity to see the world, meet lots of people, meet my beautiful wife. So, I mean, it's given me everything that I have from that standpoint. And so I think that the people in charge of West Indies cricket owe it not even to themselves anymore. Like, forget what they want. And as a collective, as a region, we need to do better in terms of coming together and not thinking about I need X amount of players from my island or my team or my friends in the team. We just need to see West Indies cricket doing well.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Kai, I just wanted to quickly ask you then. You were saying about, you know, speak to some of the lads who've just featured in the under 19 World Cup and their development now. And you mentioned there obviously the limited amount of game time that they'll probably have over the next sort of 12 months. Where would you look? What would you look to do if you was them, or if you was to give them advice now in terms of to try and further their career? Would you be looking to advise them outside of the Caribbean then, really?
100%. They have to come to England and play club cricket, continue to hone your skills, continue to get better. Because I think what lots of young players don't seem to appreciate these days is the value of the hard graft in the early stage of your career. Obviously, because T20 has become so prevalent and everyone's looking at, I can be a multi-millionaire, et cetera, all of that will happen on the basis of a good foundation as a cricketer. So once you come, you play club cricket. I mean, you're talking about 19, 18, 16, 17-year-olds. You come and you play 2, 3, 4 years of club cricket where every weekend you're on the grind, you're playing in different conditions, swinging balls. At the end of the season, the ball starts to spin. It's cold, it's wet. You're uncomfortable, you're away from home, so you have a lot of different things to do. You're the pro at a club, so you're expected to perform. So you can't just play freely as you'd like and get out recklessly. So it teaches you that professionalism. It actually provides you maybe a better breathing ground than what is available in the Caribbean at the moment. And with first class teams, pretty much not many teams are gonna be bringing in an influx of 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds every season anyway, because it's still professional sport, and everyone wants to win, everyone wants to compete, and everyone wants to produce players that go on to the other level. So it takes a while for players to develop. And so there are very few spots ever really available in any professional setup, especially for younger players coming in. You have to be exceptionally talented. You look at someone like a Joel Andrew, for example. The whole world knew he was going to play for the Leeward Islands. It doesn't matter who had to sit. He was going to come straight in because of his talent, and we want to continue to aid his development as a player and as a person. So I think it's just for players to understand that, because I mean, there's, as I said, not enough first class cricket being played anyway. If for example, the season were longer and it were a double round, so you're playing 14 first-class games, then that provides an opportunity for some of these guys to get games throughout a season, because you can say, I'm going to work this guy in with a few senior players, like here and there. So, this senior player will say to him, okay, look, you're going to miss this match because we want to continue to develop our youngsters as well, and provide them a pathway so that when you're gone, they've had 10, 15 games experience over a 2, 3 year period, so that they're not coming in green and they sort of have a feel for the environment. It's not something new to them. So even though they're young, they have the adequate experience to go on and take whichever franchise forward. But the lack of cricketing opportunities, coupled with the fact that teams, franchises want to win, doesn't provide opportunities for young players as it should.
No, I appreciate. I just wanted to ask you that question there because it's something that I've been, we discussed a little bit, but also like in terms of obviously what you discussed there. Looking ahead, obviously now in more of a positive way, where, Mash, how do you sort of see the West Indies' chances in the T20 World Cup?
I get a lot of stick whenever I answer this question. So, well, listen, do I think we'll win the competition? No. If we get to the final, I think we'll win. If we manage to get there, then I think the momentum and the vibes that would be building around the Caribbean, I would give us a very good chance of winning it if we got to the final. However, I genuinely do not expect the side to make it to the final. And I have to be careful because people often say, when I make that statement, people often say, often confuse what to me is a very kind of rational, sober judgment with not wanting to support the team, which is far from the truth. I want the team to do well. The only reason I think that we may not make it, well, not only reason, there's several. One, the volatility of T20. All it takes in a T20 game is two players in out of 11 to do some nowadays to do something completely outrageous, right? So let's just say for argument's sake, we got to the Super Eights, right? You can't afford to really lose many games in the Super Eights, so maybe one, and even with one, you might not be able to get through with losing one game. Now let's just say we played India, argument's sake, in Super Eights. All you need is someone like Sky to hit 120 or 40 balls, and the game's gone. Do you see what I mean? And because T20 is such a, or Bumrah to take a quick three wickets for 6 runs, the game's done, right? So T20 is such a volatile game that I think nobody can call any team to win a T20 World Cup just because they look good on paper. Anything can happen, generally speaking, across the length of a tournament, right? That said, do West Indies have a good team? Yes, in the batting sense, we definitely do. I think lots of teams would kill to have the power of Puran, Powell, Hetmyer or Rutherford, depending on which of those two play. Obviously, Dre, Romario, Shepherd, all of them are six hitters, and all of them could take a game away in a blink of an eye. from the opposition if it was our day. Even Johnson Charles at the top, if it's his day, he could take a game away from an opposition. So from numbers one, Brandon King, down to numbers seven or eight, depending on where Romario bats, there are game match winners in there with the bat. The big question mark I have over the West Indies team is if we have the ability to restrict teams regularly in a run chase, or say we underperformed with the bat in any given game, do we have the bowling attack to win a close game? That is my question mark, okay? So I think our bowling attack is going to look something like Alzari, Joseph, Gudakesh Moti, Akhil Hussain, Andre Russell, Romario Shepherd, that's five, and maybe Roston Chase gets in there somewhere. Maybe.
Definitely.
As I say, you're going
right. to... I would have him. I would have him, but I just don't know if they're going to be willing to drop Shea Holt to get Roston Chase in there. I don't know, right? Also, I would probably have Obed McCoy in my side, but I don't know who they're willing to leave out to get Obed McCoy into the side. So I worry against England at Christmas and India just before England in the summer, they went with a five bowler strategy. I don't recommend it. I do not believe West Indies can win a World Cup with a five bowler strategy. I just don't see us having the consistency to win it with five, which is why I think Chase has to be somewhere in the side to just give you that option. And obviously he turns it the other way from what Akhil and Gudakesh do. He gives you that option to just do something different or do something else. So that's the question mark that I don't... I want to believe that Darren Sammy and his backroom staff will be sensible enough to pick like horses for courses. So this is the 11 for this team in these conditions versus the 11. Like when we play Afghanistan, it's in St. Lucia, for example. So the 11 that play Afghanistan in St. Lucia probably shouldn't be the same 11 that plays Papua New Guinea in Guyana, because it really should be horses for courses dependent on the nature of the pitch and what the conditions are saying. Will we do that? I don't know. So in conclusion, what I will say is this. Our group's difficult. I think a lot of West Indian supporters have taken for granted that we have to get past Afghanistan and New Zealand, which won't be easy. If we can get past Afghanistan and New Zealand, and yes, I'm taking Papua New Guinea and Uganda for granted, but if we can get past Afghanistan and New Zealand, maybe momentum will be on our side. But do I think the team has the wider ability to go through what would have to be, 8 to 10 games to win the World Cup and be consistent? Not, I don't know. I think that might be a bit of a stretch.
Ash, I mean, just to your point, I've been actually following you guys' pod as well. And I saw, which I found quite interesting, like people wondering two things, which kind of slapped me upside the head. One is the debate about Roston Chase. And for me, it's what's the debate? What are we talking about? Roston Chase should not only be in the team, he should be batting at number four. He should play that anchor role that Marlon Samuels used. Because remember, it's now coined the Marlon Samuels role. Mm-hmm. But he definitely should be playing that role, in my opinion. I think that he bats at a higher strike rate than Shea Holt does. And I think that obviously his versatility in terms of being that added spinner, because you know in the Caribbean conditions, you're going to need as many slow bowler or slow bowling options as you possibly can have. And he takes the ball a different direction from Moti and Hussain. I think that that's invaluable, whereas Shea will be another keeper where you have sort of Puran and Charles playing in the 11. So that, I mean, you want to give yourselves as many chances or cover as many bases as possible. So for me, that's why I would have Chase in the starting 11. And then the other thing I saw people questioning, which again was a slap upside the head, was why Gudakesh Moti was selected and not someone else. And I don't know if people watch cricket, you know, if they just make comments, because you look at Gudakesh Moti bowl, he takes every T20, he takes 2 to 3 wickets for 20 something runs. Mm-hmm. What else do we want the man to do?
unless you want him to bowl 4 for 5. This man is literally our most consistent spinner in terms of like whatever situation you put him in, whether it's teams are going guns a-blazing. South Africa scored 190 in the last T20. He bowled 4 for 20-something and got 3 wickets. What else do you want from him? You know, I think the one that actually stands out is Akil Hussain, because he seems to be so used to opening the bowling that, like, when you ask him to bowl in the middle overs now, he seems to have not had much practice in those scenarios. So it looks as though, like, he doesn't know, I guess, what exactly he wants to achieve or how he wants to achieve it, because he's been doing so much of that role of bowling with the new ball and understanding and crafting his skill towards that. So I think that's something that we'll have to pay attention to. But like you, I think, well, for me personally, I think if the West Indies can get to the semifinals, that would be a big win for the West Indies team and for the region as well, especially being in the Caribbean. I mean, obviously we have a very good team, but the bowling is inexperienced. And so I think that West Indies on more occasions than not will choose to bowl first and bat themselves to get whatever score any opposition puts up because of, as you said, the depth and the amount of power hitting options available to the West Indies. So if it comes off, I mean, we have the ability to chase any score that anyone can put up, and because of the depth and length of the batting lineup, it gives the batters that freedom to know that you can start going from early as well, because you don't want to be wasting balls with all that power left behind. It's better to get bowled out than to think we could have scored an extra 20, 30 runs here that would have given us a buffer. So I think that would sort of be the West Indies strategy, and it'd be interesting to see when they play against teams, you know, how they go about it when they have to bowl second.
Yeah, that's that. You would assume that teams will want to bat first against the West Indies, actually, and put them under. Wait, hold on. Is that no? Yeah, it's gonna be interesting. Sorry, it's gonna be interesting to see see what teams choose to do, if they want to put West Indies under scoreboard pressure, or if they dare West Indies bowlers to try and bowl the team to a win. It's gonna be, and the problem West Indies have is that our first, I mean, some could argue it's a good thing, our first two games are against Papua New Guinea and Uganda. So in one sense, good, we should win those games and the net run rate will be healthy. In another sense, bad, because it means we don't really get going until game three. And when we get to game three, it's almost a must-win game immediately by the time we have to play New Zealand. So those two games against PNG and Uganda could either be false dawns in that it doesn't allow us to raise to the level of competitiveness we need to be at, because the jump from that to suddenly playing New Zealand will be huge, if you see what I mean. So if I'm Darren Sammy, I'm finding a way to make sure that the team goes in with an absolutely ruthless mindset against PNG and Uganda, and none of this kind of we can play in third gear and still win this match. It has to be, treat this as if it's a must-win game, to make sure that when it's the time to raise the level for New Zealand and Afghanistan, there's no kind of hindrance to have to go up a few notches, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think West Indies will beat New Zealand, you know, in Trinidad. So I think they'll go the first three. And I think what will actually be the bogeyman is I think they'll lose to
Afghanistan.
Yeah. So I think that's where the net run rate sort of comes into play and how that whole situation plays out. But for me, one X factor that the West Indies have missed in this World Cup, if Sunil Narine made himself available, it would be game over. West Indies
definitely
to the semifinals, because that's 4 overs for 15 runs and he's going to smash him.
Yeah,
that's exactly my point. That would have been the silver bullet for me. If he had been available, then I would have been confident in saying, yeah, we got a real good chance here. Obviously he's not. Kieran, actually, just before Jason comes back in, I wanted to ask you, because you just said Afghanistan will be the bogey team. Obviously, as a current player, what is it about our inability across the region to play spin well. As a player who experiences it, now you may say, well, actually, I'm quite good at spin, but in general, across the region, and particularly when we get to the international level, we seem to struggle against all kinds of spin. It's not even a particular type of spin. It's not wholly leg spin. It's not wholly left arm, right arm, whatever. What is our issue with spin? And particularly when we consider that at the regional level, spinners tend to dominate as well. And they're not even spinners who Jimbo's good, obviously. But what I'm saying is then, even Jimbo and Vasami Permol and whether Gudakesh, etc., they're good. But then when we play what I call average spinners at the international level, we tend to come unstuck.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you for realizing that I am good against spin. But... I think a lot of it goes down to the way we practice in the Caribbean and the facilities. The pitches, you know, in the Caribbean aren't great. Sometimes you see teams opening the bowling with spin. So it's a situation where the ball does a lot more than it should at certain stages of the game. And so guys feel as though that the only way to, I guess, survive or get through it is hit your way to a score before you get out. Which does two things. It doesn't prepare batters for international cricket because you're batting on pitches that you're never... So when guys go and play international cricket and come back, you hear them talking about, oh my God, the facilities, like the pitches are so much better, or the practice pitches are so much better. And then you hear bowlers talking about them not being able to get a grip on the ball. It's not that they're not able to get a grip on the ball or the pitch isn't doing as much. Mm. It's that you've not had to practice spinning the ball so that Now you come to the international level, you're just rolling it. You know, in the olden days, you hear the older guys. So I played club cricket against like almost El Comito Willett type guys, you know, Derek Parks, like guys that are very first Leeward Islanders to play for West Indies. And when they released the ball, you could hear it like fizzing coming at you, like the amount of ribs that they've put on the ball. Yeah. So it doesn't matter the surface, it's going to spin. But guys don't do that anymore. It's literally, if you put it in front of a batter long enough, it's going to do something adverse off the pitch. So as I said, it doesn't, it creates a situation where guys don't want to bat or trust their defenses enough or know how to maneuver the strike well enough based on, I guess, the way that we practice. You get to bat for 15 minutes per net still in the Caribbean, you know, things like that, where you don't get a chance to work on using your feet, hitting the ball along the ground, sweeping, reverse sweeping, all these different skills that are necessary and a part and prevalent in today's game. So I think that's probably one of the main reasons. There are a host of different things that I could, I guess, go into. That a broader topic on why I think guys are not great against spin. And I think like a lot of it has to do with exposure as well, because if we know this is a situation, for me, how I think regional cricket should work is at the end of every season, you should have sort of a camp for all the opening batters where you get the likes of a Chris Gayle, a Greenidge, a Haynes, those guys to come and impart knowledge and work with those guys for, let's say, a two-week period. So they continue to... Because you don't know which opener is going to play for West Indies, right? Mm. You don't know which middle-order batters are going to play. So you have like a middle-order batting camp and you have, you know, the Chandapals, the Laras, the Sawans, the you name it, whoever you can think of. And the same thing with the wicket keepers, the spinners, the fast bowlers. Okay, if you think that the openers need to go to a camp in the UK because our season doesn't sort of collide, you send them off to the UK and you have 2 weeks of them playing the ball in swinging conditions. You'd send the middle order batters to India so that they can improve on their work against spin, etc. And yeah, so you sort of break it down and you build it back up as a whole. So then you have a wholesome entity where, okay, I've worked on these things, so I know that my opening batters are going to get through the new ball, my middle-order batters are going to rotate the strike, and then, you know, my seamers, last year this guy was really good at in-swinging the ball, but now he's got one that goes straight on or nips away off the seam.
he's gotten fitter, so he's bowling a bit faster as well. You know, my spinners can bowl for longer spells. They can spin the ball a lot more. So just different things like that that I think that need to be implemented and incorporated into the domestic setup that will help West Indies cricket.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because obviously we're talking about the World Cup, but straight after the World Cup, we go to England for the Test series, and we're going to England. Obviously, the squad hasn't been announced, but you probably can't say anything, but I've heard that Mikal Louie is going. And I just look at the squad. If Mikal has got the pick, you're going to have a situation where you have Mikal, Kirk McKenzie, Alec Afanase, even throwing Kavem Hodge there. None of them have played in England before. And I don't think people understand that to just turn up in England, and they're all talented in their own right, but to just turn up in England and at the international level, not even club cricket, not even a team tour, and suddenly be asked to adapt at the highest level to what conditions are like in England. And this is one of the things I get confused about in West Indies cricket, that people will cuss when they inevitably face a level of difficulty with adapting to what those conditions are like. So, and we have, it's not like we've prepped them. It's not like they're in England right now, getting ready ahead of that tour. And so I agree with you when you say there are things that you can do to mitigate, but we don't seemingly do them.
Exactly. And when you think about it, sorry not to cut you off, John, but when you think about it, like most of these guys aren't involved in T20 cricket, so they're not going to be at the World Cup or anything. So what exactly are they doing at home? Like, why doesn't the West Indies board at the very least have them in a camp preparing for an England series off of the back of what was a good test match victory in Australia in that second test match? Why don't they sort of, because I'm sure West Indies cricket board has contacts enough to get some of the players over to come and play at least club cricket. Like, even if it's a situation where West Indies board takes on responsibility of like housing the players, etc., you just want them to be in the environment playing and getting used to the conditions, because as you said, it's no easy feat to just come to England and play. Like, it takes a lot of getting used to, you know, from the standpoint of the weather. Like, these guys won't be used to damp, gloomy. It's definitely not summer here yet, unless I'm lost, I'm going to the wrong place. It's not summer yet. So they're not going to be used to the weather. The pitches are a lot slower. The ball does a lot more. You have to wait a lot longer to play certain shots. Obviously, the bowlers are skillful in these conditions because this is where they grew up. And, you know, someone like Jimmy Anderson is going to want to go out with a bang and prove a point, you know. So the young guys looking to prove a point as well as to, oh, I should have had this opportunity for the past 3-4 years. Why is this man still playing? So there are lots of different things there that you think about, and you think to yourself, why are guys just at home sitting down? West Indies board, can you at least get them into a camp, start preparing them from now? Because the World Cup is going to go by very quickly, and then it's going to be the England series 8 days after that. And it's going to look like a rush job.
Yeah, definitely. I want to dive in a little bit about, you know, about them coming over. I think that especially over here in the UK, we have plenty of ECB Premier Leagues, which is obviously quite a high standard of league cricket. Now, these lads could have come over as soon as the 4-day stuff finished. They could have had plenty of time to get used to conditions and be around in terms of the environment. You know, from a bowling perspective, you know, plenty of county teams around here would have, you know, they could do some net bowling, for instance. I'm not saying it's a great, you know, it might not be, it's not, you know, a massive selling point to him, but they're bowling in these conditions over here. They're facing batters who, not necessarily be facing, but, you know, similar sort of styles of batters. And I think that, you know, I recently started watching the test on the Amazon series with Australia, and it shows them coming over before the Ashes last season, last year, and they're working in Formby. And it's all this planning and preparation. And going back to your comment before, Kai, about facing spin and things and how they can do these camps. You know, we've spoke to Faz, we spoke to Philo, not last week, the week before. And, you know, every time we speak as well, it's the same things that we speak about. And it's the same, I don't want to sound drug shit, but it really screams common sense. You know, this is not something that's, you know, out of the blue and taken somewhere and completely random idea. It's just it's simple preparation, really. And, you know, I think I mentioned it a few weeks ago. I think the West Indies have got a fantastic chance of really pushing England in this Test series. I don't know, you know, that's just my opinion, to be honest with you. I think that that's just the way I see it. And it might look stupid in 6 to 8 weeks' time after the series, but that's my opinion. And we spoke before about how to rejuvenate cricket West Indies as a whole and you know, bring back some of the glory years as such. And to get, you know, to get people back on board is to see success. But if the people behind the scenes can't just use the common sense, then I don't really see how they're going to push on.
Yeah. It's true. And I was intrigued to hear, obviously, that you both spoke to Faz in the previous episode, and that the symposium, which a lot of column pieces about it, the 2-day symposium in Trinidad and Tobago, and it feels like the wrong thing to say, but part of me, like, I was glad it happened, but then there was a part of me which was like, but we've also been here before, where everyone talks and they all say the right kind of thing, and then everyone leaves going, yeah, this now is the time the change is coming. And we'll be here 5 years later, still in the exact same place, having not done anything. So I want to believe this time will be different, but I just sometimes I despair. And I don't know if Kieran's ever interested in something like this, but I genuinely believe that obviously we don't know how the landscape of cricket will be 10 years from now, given the rise of short format cricket, etc. But let's just assume all three formats still exist in 10 years time, and there's still a proper international landscape. I do feel that with cricket across the Caribbean, it almost needs, and this is controversial because a lot of people say I shouldn't say this, but it almost needs like a generation of administrators to leave. Like there's been a lot of people have been in those jobs for a long, long time.
That's not controversial. These people have been needing to leave a generation ago.
So that's what I'm saying.
People have no clue about cricket administration. I think that Cricket West Indies needs two arms. You need the cricket side of things, and you need the cricket marketing or the business of cricket side of things.
Yeah,
I think that's where it's falling down. You look at the marketing or the lack thereof of Cricket West Indies. Tell me why there are no West Indies memorabilia, whether it be not just of the current players, but you speak of like a Narine, a Chris Gayle, even a Viv Richards, for people coming in from outside of the region. They will snap those things up in a heartbeat. You're talking about even at games or even before games, like obviously the touring parties, it's an opportunity to have a lunch with Viv Richards, a seminar, a golf day, so many different things that Cricket West Indies can put on. But, you know, the lack of, let me not say the lack of wanting to do it. Maybe they just don't know how, which is unfortunate because that's the positions that they're in. But the generation of cricket administration personnel in the Caribbean definitely needs to be long gone, the current group, because as you said, there's some of them that have been in these positions for 15, 20, 30 years. There's this one individual, I can't say his name or else I might get banned, but I know he's been there for X amount of years, which sort of coincides with the decline of West Indies cricket, is how I like to put it, his tenure and the decline of West Indies cricket. So I think it's about time that we start looking at new people, new ideas, new ways of thinking, because the game has evolved, the game has changed, and we also need to change and evolve as well.
100%. Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to get both your opinions here in terms of, I know you mentioned there about potentially Mikel Lewis featuring and Alec Athanase and Kevin Hodge coming over, and it's, you know, their first experience, and we discussed that then. What What impact could it have on them in terms of if it was to be a really poor series, and the fact that they was to be, you know, could be beaten quite comprehensively, then, you know, the young side, you know, batting wise really struggle, and from a confidence perspective, and that then impacting the, you know, West Indies as you know, from a test playing side of things as well.
Do you know, I'm going to answer that, and then I guarantee Kieran's going to want to say something after I've said this. So I will just say the following, because Kieran's testament to what I'm about to say. We have a history in West Indies cricket of promoting players into the West Indies team and then not giving them a chance to actually know their game and cement themselves properly in the West Indies team. Every now and again, somebody actually gets a long run, right, to prove whether they can hang at the international level or not. But we're more likely to give someone, what, 4-5 tests, you're out. And that's, and then you go back, no one's helping you to kind of find out, well, this is why we've dropped you for now. Go away and work on this. Who's going to work with you? What, as Kieran said earlier, what level 4, level 3 coach is going to work with you to address those deficiencies that have been picked up at the international level? Okay, so now you go back to domestic cricket. You top the run charts. You're back again. But no one ever worked with you in the interim. Right. How long have I got this time? What, 3 tests? 4 tests? 1 test series? Maybe I'll get 2. You're out again. So we have a history, and I'm laughing because it's ridiculous. We have a history where you come into a team, you're not really given a chance to develop. Remember, this is the highest level of cricket we're talking about. Yeah. You're not really given a metric as to, we're going to keep picking you. We believe in you. You know, sometimes, and this is all sports, sometimes a sports person needs to know, I have faith in you. I'm not going to drop you after 1 failure, 2 failure, 3 failures, right? So this is why I worry for, if Louis goes there, for example, this is why I worry for the young ones when they come through. Because you can also look at it at the flip side, which is that you pick the young ones because there's also politics in selection, of course. You pick the young ones and you signal to the Caribbean, this is the new way we're going in, right? We're going with the young ones now. Now the selectors have faith from everyone because it's like, well, you know, we got to give the youngsters a chance. You know, they're young, et cetera, et cetera. But has anyone actually ascertained if they're ready for that opportunity? You don't just give youngsters a chance because they're young. Have you actually ascertained where they're at with their knowledge of the game? Are they ready for the jump that they're going to have to do? And also, sorry, I'm passionate about this. Also, there's ways to introduce a youngster. So, for example, if I'm introducing a youngster into international cricket, Bangladesh are playing against us. We're at home against Bangladesh at the end of the year. Maybe that's an easier tour to introduce a youngster to. Not England away. That's you're basically saying to someone, sink or swim. Like, you're going to England and you either sink or swim. And because we're so ridiculous, don't be surprised if one of these youngsters fails in England after 3 tests and then they're out. They're just out. They're not picked for the next test series and they're out and they're told to go and work on their game. And I just think things like that, we almost set our players up for failure. And we also, and this is the last thing, I'm certain Kieran's coming in now, we also write our players off very quickly. So, I mean, we just had, I know Kieran spoke about this, last year we had, Darren Bravo topped the run score charts in Super 50, didn't get picked. He was told he's too old, right? We must be the only region I know in world cricket where we just write players off and say, nah, runs don't matter. You're too old, so you can't get in the team. So we don't have I've always felt that we never have a very clear strategy and approach to selection, and more importantly, development within selection. And I'll, do you know what? I'll even throw Alzari in there. Alzari Joseph is 27 now. We threw him into West Indies international setup straight out of Under-19 World Cup. We didn't even give him a developmental pathway. We just saw he was good at Under-19 level and said, yep, in he comes. And Alzari's good. I'm not trying to criticise Alzari at all, but I often look at Alzari and say, how good could Alzari have been if we'd actually developed him properly and basically didn't say to him, work it out as you go along? in international cricket. It doesn't, you wouldn't see that happen. You wouldn't see England play a 19-year-old and just say, work it out. Go on, just work it out on the international stage. There'd be a clear developmental process which got them ready before we just thrust them onto the main scene. Kieran, I'm sure you're going to want to come in.
Well, let's work backwards from the Darren Bravo issue, because on a serious footing now, you've seen what that's done to him. He's not playing cricket anymore. Like, he's literally stopped playing cricket, and I don't know if the selectors or the regional boards understand the impact that has on a region like the Caribbean, where you're losing a player that's still performing, even if it's just domestically, at that level, because we don't have many guys that perform across both 50 over and 40 cricket in the Caribbean. There are a handful of guys that perform well in both formats of the game. And for somewhere like Trinidad and Tobago, Jason Mohammed was still one of their top run scorers this season. They rely heavily on those two guys. And so their cricketing, I guess, environment is going to take a huge blow, losing that caliber of player. And so will West Indies cricket, because I'm sure, I guess, throughout the course of a season, he may offer a word of advice to a player from different islands. And that may be something that triggers or helps that player in whatever minuscule little way. And I think that, as you said, like, it's crazy that we're telling players, or someone at the age of, I think he's 35, that he's too old, when Usman Khawaja is 37.
Yeah.
And is going to play for Australia until he's probably 39 at the end of the Ashes next year. You know, so what are we talking about? I didn't know that runs had an age to it. I think that you're good enough as long as you're scoring runs. But what do I know? I've only been scoring runs for the past how many years? But I think on another standpoint, when you talk about the impact that, I guess, maybe a failed tour can have on these young players, it could be devastating, because, again, back to my point where I stress that we don't play enough cricket in the Caribbean, that naturally tells you that these guys are coming in based off of very few matches, so they don't have experience of, for example, someone like a Mikhail Louie, he doesn't have experience of dealing with failure. So then if what you've known in your 7-game professional career is success, and you come to England and the ball starts doing so much more against players of such a higher quality of standard than what you'd have faced in the region, how do you build yourself back up from that? Because you then plunge yourself into a pit, an abyss that you've never been into before. You've never had to deal with anything like that before. And you've got no one, as I said, in the region that's sort of helped you or is going to understand what you're going through to help you out of that situation. So it gets even more difficult when you understand that the next tour is South Africa and the Caribbean. And it's Ngidi and Rabada and Nokia and Kotsi and those guys that are going to be lining up. It's there's no hiding place in international cricket. No. And as you said, Mash, like, you know, they give a guy a series or two at max, but you're not gonna get 10 games and not have any returns and the team be losing and your name's not gonna be called, you know. So it's a difficult space to be for these young players, but I guess it's a survival of the fittest kind of thing. It's going to war. You have to You kill or you be killed. So you have to find a way of performing. And it's pretty much as simple as that. Or it's just on to the next one, unfortunately.
Kieran, just to ask you, because this is just, I guess, a good follow-up to what you just said there. So the last time you played Test cricket was the Pakistan series, right? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
And before that, we had South Africa. Am I right?
Yep.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, you scored a 50 against South Africa in one of, I think you You may have second been test match.
I came in as a concussion.
Shea got injured or something, or someone got injured and you came in, and you scored a 50. And then against Pakistan, okay, you were low on runs. So what was the conversation when you didn't play again after that? So you just scored a 50 against South Africa, having come in as concussion, then had the two tests against Pakistan, haven't been picked since. When you, like, what do they say to you? I've always wondered what is said when someone isn't picked, because I've been to press conferences in the last 2 years where questions are put to selectors and you're like, where's this guy? And selectors are talking like they don't know. Like they don't know that they didn't pick the guy. So what conversations actually go on?
Well, I'll give you a full sequence of events here. So funnily enough, that South Africa series, remember that's when they said that they're going to try and convert Shea into a test match.
Yeah.
Right, correct. So I was selected, but I was selected on the bench, and then Bana got concussed.
That's it.
So yeah. I was on the field as a sub fielder. And our coach didn't even, Phil Simmons didn't even tell me I was in. It was the umpire from Trinidad, Joel Wilson. He's the one that said, "Oh, so what number are you batting?" So I was like, "I'm not playing." He said, "Oh, you've been signed off as the concussion sub." I was like, "Oh shit, okay, cool." So I got into the dressing room now, and obviously, it's literally the first innings of the first test match is just gone, right? So we're just into the second innings. You've just said you're converting Shea into a test opener. So I've come in thinking naturally, okay, I'm batting at three because you've literally just 1 innings ago, 2 days ago, you've said this man is the opener. So Phil Simmons comes down again, doesn't say anything to me. He just looks at Shea and says, "Oh, you're batting at three." So shit, okay, that means I'm opening then. Let me get my shit on. I'm looking around. It's like, is it me? Is it? No. Okay. Well, so off we go. Played the second test match. Got a 50 in the second innings. Now played the Pakistan series. After that, there was the best of the best. And that's when West Indies went to Sri Lanka after. And they picked Jeremy Solozano. The tune of
Solozano got hurt. Solozano got hurt in Sri Lanka.
He got hit at short leg. He didn't even get a chance to bat or anything. So I'll give you a full sequence of events now. I think it was Roger Harper that was the chairman of selectors. They said to me they wanted to try something. That's what I was told. So I was like, well, why do you have to try with me? I've just come back in the team and try with somebody else. Why do you have to try with me? So funnily enough now, we went to Sri Lanka. Anyway, because Emma's family is out there, we went to spend some time with her mom, her brother, etc. Solozano gets hurt. I am in Sri Lanka. I was just playing the best of the best. So you're down to 14 men. You don't have an opener, but you have someone that just opened for you in the test match before this in the country. Nothing.
Right. Did they know you were in Sri Lanka?
I was taking food for them in the lead up to in the lead up to the match. If they didn't know, then I don't know who they thought was bringing the food.
That chef looks awkward, recognizable.
No, but do you know what? On a serious note, because I wouldn't ask you to go any further, but. That for me is my point, though. That almost explains the point that I'm trying to make, which is that we don't have the clearest. You could argue we don't have a system, but we're not very good at the communication with players as to role, length, trust. And this is why we always have this familiar kind of stories that come out about communication breakdown and why certain players are saying they don't want to get picked for West Indies or I refuse selection, I'm unavailable, because we don't have good communication. It's another one of those barriers that prevents our cricket being the best version of itself.
Yeah. I just to wrap this up, I just think, though, that knowing, obviously, UK, you're mentally strong enough to be able to sort of, and resilient enough to, you know, to as probably You know, it had an impact on you hearing that. And, you know, you probably question a lot of the decision-making stuff. But the young group of players that we just discussed before, they might not be. So they might get this, you know, they might get dropped after the second test or the third test before the series against Bangladesh. And they might get that communication or lack of communication. And all of a sudden, the career goes back two or three steps. And the impact that has on them as a whole, but also on West Indies cricket overall, it can have a massive impact and be really detrimental to these lads' careers. And it is just lack of communication and lack of understanding about how to help them along the way and things. And I just hope, from my perspective, and obviously spending time with Kieran and listening to him, you know, over the past sort of 12 to 18 months, that they start to listen to people who really know what they're talking about, who've got real understanding of the game and have a real care of cricket and the Caribbean cricket overall.
I mean, fortunately enough for me, we've got life outside of cricket, and I'm in a position where I'm fortunate enough to be educated as well. I'm currently doing my master's, as you know, Jordan. So these things are just a hurdle in my life's journey. But for the younger guys that, I guess, don't have, I guess, these same avenues, whether it be through education or whatever the case is, it could be quite, I guess, a distorting situation where someone is head over heels in love with the West Indies cricket, and then they start to feel as the West Indies cricket doesn't love it, but love them back, which is not the case. It may be just the individuals in a position of power to make a call over your career at that point doesn't love you back. So I guess they have to learn to understand and differentiate the two over time, and hopefully.
Yes, so just hopefully these younger guys can just find a way to, I guess, differentiate the pain, because every West Indian cricketer has a story.
Yeah.
Every West Indian cricketer can tell you about the pain of, you know, whatever they feel sort of cut short, or opportunities that they didn't get, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's just for these younger guys to see what's happened in the past, learn from it, and I guess make good decisions on and off the field, more importantly, so as to better themselves. Because the last thing I want to see is anyone having scale to the heights. And let's not take it for granted. Playing international cricket is a privilege. You know, it's not something that's given to ever and anyone. You know, you talk about a world of how many billions of people, and you have 300 and something people that have represented the West Indies out of a world of how many billions. So it's an absolute privilege. But the last thing I want to see is someone scale those heights and then come back down to suffering or struggling throughout the rest of their life, you know?
No, I agree. The knock-on effect and things, you just hope that, you know, it doesn't have that negative impact and stuff. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Mash. It's been really insightful, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your night to come and join us. And I wish you all the best with your, you know, the Caribbean Cricket Podcast, and I hope everything goes, you know, flourishingly well with it.
No worries, man. And to all listening to this, who, if they came to it via Caribbean Cricket Podcast handles, make sure you continue to follow the Power Play Podcast. Go back and listen to all the episodes. In fact, as we were recording, I just retweeted the one with Fazir, so you should have a whole
bunch. I did actually say that.
You should have a whole bunch of listens just off the back of that one. But but yeah, people, make sure you go carry on listening to the Power Play Podcast. Go back through all of their archive episodes, and thank you guys for having me on. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much, guys. Much appreciated. Cheers, guys.
Thank you for joining us. Cheers, on the Power Play Podcast, hosted by Kieran Powell and Jordan Shannon. We hope you enjoyed this immersive dive into the world of cricket and business, exploring the unique experiences and perspectives of players past and present, alongside those invaluable insights into intriguing business themes that transcend beyond the boundaries of sporting heroics. Be sure to set your reminders on your Alexa or Google Home device, Or we won't tell anyone if you still use those paper calendar things from a bygone era. Join us next time for more inspiring dialogue with scintillating minds on the Power Play Podcast.